Hi, everybody.
Hi.
Welcome to our first meeting. And I am the chair. So I think what we'll do, we have a list. First of all, you have a list, and I think I'll go over some just some committee procedures here. But in the packet, you have our committee procedures, and we'll obey them most of the time, except when I find it necessary that we can't. But there is some comment in here on radios and electronic devices, and we're being told that even in the audience, if your cell phone and that is on, that it sends signals that and screws up the recordings. So, first offense for any lobbyists that your phone rings, it's a case of beer from my office. And then the second, it's annual or monthly. So, but I we're going to have to find out from staff on that, because I know that I see people text messaging and doing other things all the time and looking at the computers in the audience. I thought it was just at the table that, remember, Carol, when your phone would ring last year, would buzz, you know. So we'll check on that item on number 9 here in our, and make sure that it's just us that are supposed to have our phones off, or everyone in the audience, too. So welcome, everybody. Do we have a quorum? I guess we do. Why don't we start by introductions then? And Larry, why don't you just go ahead and start?
I'm glad that you asked. Good afternoon. I'm Larry Hines. I'm a representative from St. Cloud.
Sarah, do you want to?
Sure. I'm Sarah Anderson. I represent Plymouth and Medicine Lake, which is on the western side of Twin Cities.
And Sarah, you're the lead on the higher education.
On the workforce.
Or workforce.
And I'm Representative Detmer from District 52A in the Forest Lake area.
Kim Norton, representing Rochester. Carol McFarland, representing Waverly Lake.
Keith Downey from District 41A, which is Edina.
Anita Newman from House Research.
I'm Doug Berg. I'm the fiscal analyst for this committee.
I'm Carrie Fine. I'm the new committee administrator.
And I'm Tom Mercavina. I represent the heart and soul of the state of Minnesota, Minnesota's Iron Man. So.
And I'm Sue Scott, the committee legislative assistant.
I'm Representative David Bly from Northfield, Lonsdale, and Belle Plaine.
Representative Andy Welty, District 30B, which encompasses Olmsted and Wabasha counties.
I'm Roger Reinert. I'm downrange from the chairman in Duluth, and I represent the central and western part of the city, and in my day job, I'm a college teacher.
And I might add, folks, you know, that Mike Jaro sat next to me for 22 years at the legislature, and I'm wondering why you didn't.
I requested Mr. Chairman.
Kathy Briner, District 23B in Mankato.
Jean Packey, representative from Austin.
Bob Gunther, District 24A, and I think I've served this committee the second most years next to Representative Clark, who's been here since Marco Polo was a Mesco.
What school is Marco?
I'm Mary Murphy. I represent District 6B, which is part of the southern part of St. Louis County and the northeast part of Carlton County.
Karen Clark, and I represent three inner-city neighborhoods in South Minneapolis.
I'm Mike Obermuller. I represent the east side of Eagan, District 38B.
And I'd like to welcome all the former members back, and the new members, it's a pleasure to have all of you. Bud, did we get you?
No, you didn't, Mr. Chairman. I was following the rules, had to go outside to make a phone call.
Okay. So, or you could have just contributed to my beer fund.
Bud Nornes, District 10A, representing Fergus Falls, and it was 35 below this morning, by the way.
And embarrassed, it was 34 only, so.
Oh.
We had a warm-up.
This was the lake, so maybe that makes a difference.
Before I forget, well, I'll wait until Representative Mahoney. Representative Mahoney's not here. But I do, well, I should mention it. On Thursday, we're already going to have a bill in front of the committee, so I just want you to be aware that on Thursday, Representative Mahoney fast-tracking a bill dealing with unemployment insurance, and he can maybe fill you in towards the end of the hearing after we hear from Commissioner McElroy, and I believe Lee Nelson. I saw Lee come in the room, so we'll maybe just hear quickly about that. But Commissioner, then, why don't you come on up, and whoever staff is going to be with you, and invite them up, and welcome to the committee. Before the Representative Mahoney, I just mentioned that your bill is going to be voted on, or you hope that it's going to be voted in on Thursday.
Expect to be voted on Thursday.
And so, sure. Towards the end, when we get time, we'll just have a little brief discussion on it from you, or Mr. Nelson is here, so you just might want to just tell everybody what they're in for.
I certainly can do that.
Okay. Welcome, Commissioner. Pleasure to see you.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. My name is Dan McElroy. I'm the Commissioner of the Department of Employment and Economic Development. And with me are a number of key team members, Mark Galapas, who heads the Business and Community Development, Bonnie Elsie, who is in charge of Workforce Development, Dr. Steve Hine, who heads Labor Market Information, Lee Nelson is here, Lynn Batsley, our Legislative Liaison, Chuck Hamilton, who manages State Services for the Blind, and Cindy Farrell, our financial person. So I'm going to make a presentation, but if you ask questions that are more detailed, Mr. Chairman, I'll be calling those folks down to help. For the benefit of those of you who are new to the committee, let me provide a little basic background on, if I figure out how to change, there we go. DEED is everything in state government is known by its acronym, but the actual name is Employment Economic Development. It was created by the legislature in 2000, and by merging two previous departments, and came into existence in 2003, so it's about coming up on 5.5 years old. Merged the former Department of Trade and Economic Development and the former Department of Economic Security. Because we believed, and still believe, and think we did exactly the right thing, that workforce development and economic development are very closely related, and that work is best done together. The department has a great and simple mission. When it came together, the leadership team wrote a one-sentence mission statement that we exist to support the economic success of individuals, businesses, and communities. And I'm very proud of that mission statement. We have it plastered all over our offices. We talk about it at every one of our meetings. We are in the business of helping, and we think those are connected, that individuals are successful when businesses and communities are successful and vice versa. And so we think it's a great mission statement. The goals are to create and retain jobs in Minnesota, to help strengthen the workforce, and so it fits jobs. We cultivate entrepreneurs. We help foster self-sufficiency. And there's some great programs in our agency, vocational rehabilitation for those with barriers to work, and state services for the blind, and veterans job services. And we're very proud of the role those play in helping foster economic success. We work with communities on programs like the financing of water treatment and sewage treatment plants, remediation of brownfield and contaminated sites, the redevelopment of previous industrial sites, and have a number of community programs, including a program for small cities that are not otherwise entitled to CDBG dollars, are eligible for our small cities grants program. And we also help communities and companies address economic change in a variety of ways, and we're proud of that. Before I begin telling you more about the agency, the chairman asked if we would address what happened, what was done in unallotment. I'll get into some detail about our budget, but DEED's budget is fairly complicated. It is a relatively small amount of general fund dollars that leverages federal funds, funds from the Workforce Development Fund, and unemployment financing is separate. But as part of the governor's unallotment to deal with the 2009 budget deficit, we were asked to cut our operating program by $900,000. That's out of an annual general fund budget of about $40 million. And we've had two special funds, a portion of them unallotted. So it's $900,000 from operations, $310,000 by holding open some positions, $281,000 from a carry forward of an operating account from 2008, and $309,000 from an unexpended balance in the extended employment program. And then there were two specific programs unallotted, $1.5 million from the 21st Century Mineral Fund. And I want to make clear that all the commitments we had made to companies like Steel Dynamics and Magnetation and SR are met, and this is dollars that were in excess of the commitments we had made. And then $700,000 from the Minnesota Investment Fund. This was $700,000 out of a $1 million appropriation to help communities with biomass heating conversion of projects. We hadn't had any applications for that fund. So of that $1 million, we had zero applications. We have retained $300,000 in the event that we get an application. We have not had any so far. So that's how an allotment was handled for the 2009 budget. We also dealt with a federal unallotment under the Workforce Investment Act. In federal unallotments, we had three federal program years, so 06, 07, 08, to deal with this. It was a $1.2 million reduction. We dealt with that inside state government. We didn't allocate that to the workforce service areas. It was all dealt with by holding open positions and reducing some expenditures inside the state office. Now, let me get on to kind of how DEWE does its work. I want to talk about the current unemployment situation and then answer your questions about both our programs and unemployment. But we're organized into three divisions. DEWE has approximately 1,600 employees. They work in business and community development, which is charged with that portion of the mission where we help businesses and communities. They run programs like Job Opportunity Building Zone, Small Cities Development Grant. It has a relatively small number of people, but they do very important work. There are about 150 people in that division. The Unemployment Insurance Division is funded by employer taxes. The benefits are paid out of state unemployment insurance taxes. The administrative costs come from the federal FUTA tax, Federal Unemployment Tax Account. That division, and we'll talk more about unemployment in a little bit, is located about 40 of their 500 employees are in workforce centers around the state. The majority are in the state office in St. Paul and in the call center in St. Cloud. The Workforce Development Division is our largest division in terms of people and includes the work done, as I mentioned, in vocational rehabilitation, in state services for the blind, in veterans employment services, in services under the Workforce Investment Act to help people with job training and both adults and youth, and under the Federal Wagner-Peiser Act under job services to assist people in finding new employment. And we partner heavily with others in those programs. We partner with the 16 statewide workforce service agencies who operate 47 workforce centers around the state. I have now visited 46 of the 47 workforce centers, and it's an opportunity to meet with both people who deliver services but those who need our services. And I have to tell you, every month when I have to announce the unemployment rate, I'm a little frustrated when reporters think those are numbers, and what I know is that they're people. And the current unemployment situation is deeply concerning. What we announce is a statewide unemployment rate, and I can talk more about this in a minute. But for families that have lost a job, their personal unemployment rate may be 100%. And so our job is to help them get both get unemployment when they qualify and get the help they need to get back to work. And so that's one of the reasons we think that bringing these functions together was such a good idea, because we can tighten the connection between unemployment insurance, workforce services, and job creation through economic development. This map shows the 47 locations across the state. There are 11 workforce centers in the metro area and 36 in greater Minnesota. They work in a wide variety of partnerships. Six of them are co-located on Minnesota State College and University campuses. A number of them are in county service buildings, human service buildings around the state. We have them co-located with the University of Minnesota Extension Service and with in-city multi-service buildings and a wide variety of partners. Virtually all the 47 workforce centers have local WSA employees. Many have state employees of various programs. Some have MNSCU employees. A couple have employees from the Department of Labor and Industry that work on their workers' comp issues. And there are a wide variety of kind of creative partners. The University of Minnesota Extension is in several workforce centers. There are migrant worker service people in some centers. The Disability State Services for the Blind, Veterans Employment, and Voc Rehab is in many centers, sometimes on a couple of day-a-week basis. So the workforce centers are the front line of the work we do with helping workers. We also connect with employers a great deal in those centers. We have about 35 people called business service specialists that connect with business to help them find their qualified employees and connect to our various programs. Because of the need, Mr. Chairman, as you have pointed out, for service in the workforce centers, we're now having the business service specialists spend at least one day a week, and there will be cases where they'll spend more time in the workforce centers on the front line assisting workers, and we appreciate the flexibility and the ability to do that. These programs are in the context of very challenging economic times. Minnesota is part of a broad national economy and has struggled, as we all know. And the worldwide recession is affecting every state. And in some respects, Minnesota is doing a little better than the nation. Our job loss is a little less large. It's 1.1% of the workforce compared to 1.5% nationally. That's not very comforting to people who have lost their jobs. And in November, the state's unemployment rate was 6.4%. That's lower than the national rate, which has now been updated to 6.8% for November. For December, the national rate is 7.2%. We expect Minnesota's December rate to be announced on January 22nd. I don't know what it is yet. I'm deeply concerned it will be quite a bit higher than November. That masks the fact, however, that the unemployment rate is different in different corners of the state. And, Mr. Chairman, we announce county unemployment rates on a little different basis. They're not seasonally adjusted, but they're pretty close for comparison purposes. And for the November unemployment ranged from a high in Clearwater County and Kanabic County and Manoman County of above 10% to a low in Clay County, which is where Moorhead is the county seat, of 3%. And so the statewide average, to some extent, masks fairly sharp regional differences. A majority of the jobs we've lost have been in the metropolitan area, which is a little unusual in a Minnesota recession. But many of the sectors that have been hard hit are heavily concentrated in the Twin Cities. The Twin Cities, the 7-county unemployment rate is about at the statewide average, a little over 6%. The areas that are low are in southwestern and western Minnesota and in the Fargo-Moorhead area. Counties that are fairly sparse in northwestern, north-central Minnesota, and then Kanabic and Aiken are the highest counties. One of the things that caused Minnesota to have a higher unemployment rate sooner than some of our surrounding states is the downturn in housing. Downturn in housing started in late 2005, accelerated in 2006, got dramatically worse since then. In Representative Rocavina's district, we've seen it by a downturn in wood products manufacturing and forest products. Minnesota has 7 branded strand board and plywood plants, and only a couple of them are operating. Most of them are either permanently closed or in mothballs. In industries like single-family residential construction, building materials manufacturing, and which includes things like windows and doors and paint and kitchen cabinet and a wide variety of things, we've lost about 16,000 jobs. We've lost another 5,000 jobs in mortgage-related mortgage finance, real estate closures, real estate positions, and about 5,000 jobs in building products distribution. So a total of 26,000 jobs directly related to the downturn in housing. We've gone from about 38,000 new housing starts in 2004, I believe. It's a wrong economist, but I think that's right. Well, if it's wrong, Dr. Hein just does jobs, things like housing starts, Bob Isaacson does, but I think it was 2004. And this year, 2008, the year just passed, we're estimating housing starts at fewer than 8,000. So we're down 75% in 4 years in housing starts. and that has just been a devastating impact on a very large industry. That's kind of led us in to this downturn. We have had, since then, we have seen job loss in almost every sector of the economy, some much worse than others. But the we also are affected by things like restructuring in the airline industry, downsizing at Ford Motor Company, and a variety of other things. The things that caused the greatest challenge was the downturn in housing. And despite this, you know, Minnesota has a robust economy. Our per capita income for 2007 is 12th in the nation, and $91 out of 10th, incidentally, so we continue to be strong. There was a number from the first quarter of 2008 that caused a lot of concern. For the first quarter of 2008, our personal income growth ranked 48th in the nation, behind only Mississippi and Alabama. Well, it turned out that that was an anomaly over when bonuses were reported in the collection tool that the Bureau of Economic Analysis used. And by second quarter and third quarter, we were back to our traditional role of having reasonably good personal income growth, not as good as we would like. For the 12 months ended at the end of third quarter 08, compared to the 12 months ended at third quarter 07, our personal income growth was 18th in the nation. It's reflected in the fact that just the downturn in housing alone took out $400 million of payroll out of Minnesota's economy. And so personal income growth isn't what we would like it to be. It wasn't as dramatically bad as the first quarter of 08 might have led us to believe. That appears to be a statistical anomaly. We calculate per capita gross state product, and we ranked 9th overall, up from 10th in 2006. And the closest neighbor to us is Iowa, who is 23rd. And so the economy is not performing as well as we would like, but relative to states around us, we continue to be doing. But that isn't very satisfying to me. I'm anxious to have it get back where unemployment is low and personal income growth is high. But those are the facts. Mr. Chairman, I think I see a hand raised for questions. Do you want me to?
Representative Mahoney, can you wait, or do you want to jump in now? Go ahead.
I've been waiting since 10:30.
Okay.
Commissioner McElroy, I mean, your comments to the committee here kind of all were around the fact that Minnesota's not doing too bad. It's a pretty good state. We're 48th in per capita income, but that's the statistic that the governor used, but now it's an anomaly and we're really only 18th or 12th or something like that. Maybe you can answer this, maybe you can't, but the governor keeps going around saying we're such a terrible environment for business and for, as a state, we're in such deep, deep doo-doo. Is there a reason why the governor keeps telling tales out there?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mahoney.
Come in.
I heard I suspect the same speech you did, in which the governor was fairly careful to say that the area where we rank challenging is in business taxes. In most other area of business competition, like vibrancy of our workforce, number of Fortune 500 and Fortune 1000 companies, number of successful private companies, we do very well. Our taxes are high. He has often said, to some extent, that's part of our culture. But we need to be careful not to have them this competitively high. I haven't heard him quote that statistic from the first quarter of 08 about 48th in personal income growth. I've heard others use it. And it's true. It was in the paper. It's accurate. But it turned out to be a statistical anomaly and to be corrected as we got more information later in the year. Mr. Chairman, I'm Representative Mahoney. The area the governor's concerned about is that while we have a large budget deficit and the states around us have large budget deficits, we need to be careful as we address that we don't create a circumstance where we're less competitive to keep and attract good-paying jobs. Not a simple issue. One I know we will all have a debate about, but that, to the best of my knowledge, Representative Mahoney is what he was specific to talk about, and that was business taxes. In some other areas, we win some battles with surrounding states that have lower taxes. We do it because we have such a good workforce. We have great transportation access to the Mississippi River and major railroads and the Great Lakes. We have a great support system and strong industry clusters. But taxes are, on many days, a challenge. That's why the South Dakota Economic Development Commission advertises so much in Minnesota. But they don't win them all.
I'll save the rest of my comments.
Well, we have a little break here. I represent Atkins and Easton. We did introductions. Do you guys want to just introduce yourselves to the committee?
Sure. I'm Joe Atkins.
Where are you from, Joe?
I say Don Joe. If you're from Texas, I also represent South St. Paul and Sussex Lake.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Rob Eastland. I'm from just north of the Metro Cambridge and Essanay area.
And I should have asked our both our DFL and Independent Republican staff to go ahead. So why don't you two introduce yourself? Go ahead.
I'm Laura Sale from DFL right here.
I'm Mike Ballou from
And our pages, Jeff, you start it, and then Andy.
I'm Jeff Wanna.
Jeff, you want to say where you recently graduated from, and where are you from?
I'm from Virginia, Minnesota.
Surprise. Okay. And? Well, thank you. Sorry, Commissioner.
No problem, Mr. Chairman.
Commissioner, where are you from? That's right, I knew.
From Burnsville in Dakota County, Mr. Chairman. So with those factual backgrounds, what does we do to assist individuals, businesses, and communities? The department delivers economic workforce and community development through a biennial budget that's $742 million in everything but, this gets a little complicated. I'm going to address the budget for unemployment insurance and the Public Facilities Authority separately. But for business and community development and workforce development, the budget is $742 million. We gave you a pie chart that is in your handout and is also on the screen. And it attempts to explain how the budget works. And with me is Cindy Farrell, who's available if you have more detailed questions. But our base budget, and this is the projection of the base budget for 2010 and 11, before any adjustments, is $742 million. That comes $507 million, or 68%, from federal funds. That comes in a lot of contracts for federal services. We have contracts with the U.S. Department of Labor, Department of Training Administration for the Workforce Investment Act and Wagner-Pfizer Act. We get funds from the U.S. Department of Education for vocational rehabilitation, state services for the blind. We get funds from the HUD, Housing and Urban Development, for the small cities grants. We get funds from the U.S. Department of Health and the U.S. Pollution Control Administration for programs in the Public Facilities Authority. We get funds from the Veterans Service Administration for our veterans programs. Labor market information is funded from another area of the U.S. Department of Labor. We get some U.S. Department of Commerce assistance with our trade office. That $507 million is made up of a large number of federal agreements, many of which have maintenance of effort or state match requirements. Of the state general fund portion of $86 million, 77%, or $66 million, is in the workforce development, and much of it, not all of it, but much of it, is the state match for programs like vocational rehabilitation, state services for the blind, and veterans affairs. And in crafting our budget recommendations, we're careful to maintain that maintenance of effort, because in some cases a dollar of state resources brings down as much as $4 of federal resources in programs like state services for the blind. The Business and Community Development Division is principally state-funded. It's $15 million in programs like the contaminated sites cleanup, the redevelopment fund, and the people that it takes to run our small business development centers, our Office of Science and Technology, and the other programs that assist business. The administrative portion of the agency, which includes the commissioner's office, accounting, information technology, research, rent, insurance, a couple of state cars, is about $5 million, and although that's a modestly large percentage of our general fund budget, in our all funds budget, we think we've kept administration at a relatively low rate. So that covers where the money comes from. We can get into as much detail as you like. In addition to that, DEED is a partner in and the host agency for Minnesota's Public Facilities Authority. You'll often hear it called the PFA. Public Facilities Authority is made up of the Departments of Employment and Economic Development, Natural Resources, Pollution Control Agency, the Department of Agriculture, the Department of Transportation, the Department of Finance. And it was created by the legislature 25 years ago, approximately, in 87, so 21 years ago. Thank you, Mark. To assist communities in funding local sewage treatment plants and principally local clean water plants. It leverages a revolving loan fund, some of which have been state dollars and some are federal dollars, a grant program, the Wastewater Infrastructure Fund, and a couple of smaller funds, the phosphorus grants and some clean water grants, and a small transportation revolving loan fund. The for the full year, for the two-year period, the PFA is likely to finance about $520 million in projects. And to provide some level of subsidy to keep clean water and environmentally responsible sewage treatment affordable in Minnesota. The unemployment insurance program has really two components. One is the benefits that are paid. In 2008, we paid approximately $875 million in regular state-funded benefits and about $130 million in the federal extension. Those are all unemployment benefits come from employer taxes. The state portion comes from state tax, and we have provided a handout, a one-page handout that says at the top, unemployment insurance in Minnesota, that I think is in your packets, provides a lot of the facts that I will talk about. It's supposed to be, I see some people have found it. The administrative costs of unemployment come from the federal unemployment tax account paid from the U.S. Department of Labor. We get a grant of $42 million to administer unemployment insurance. Mr. Chairman, it was a year ago tomorrow that I was before this committee to defend the fact that we had a new unemployment insurance system and it didn't work well, and it inconvenienced many of our customers. I have to tell you that that was a very tough time. We got it working about that time. And today we are very grateful that we made that investment because the new system is able to pay a much larger number of people. Last week we had 105,000 Minnesotans collecting benefits under our regular program, or 105,000 benefits, and about 30,000 weeks of benefits on the extension. That compares to 65,000 weeks in the comparable week a year ago, although it's not quite apples to oranges because we weren't under an extension at that time. But the 105,000 to 65,000 is an accurate comparison. If we hadn't made the investment in the new system, I don't believe we would have been able to successfully pay people or pay people timely as we did. The unemployment insurance systems in four states melted down last week. New York, the most dramatically, they were down for 4 days because the volume was more than they can handle. Now, there are still days that it takes longer to get through to us than I like. A year ago, we had horrendous holding times. Last week, our average hold time on Monday and Tuesday was about 10 minutes, and later in the week, about 7 minutes. The longest hold times, and I wasn't satisfied with average, because that means that some people wait a lot longer, so they report also the longest. And the longest were about 25 minutes on Monday and Tuesday, and they get dramatically shorter later in the week. So if you get people who call you and say, I'm trying to get a hold on unemployment, it takes too long. If they call us Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday, they have a dramatically shorter hold time than if they need to talk to us on Monday and Tuesday. Now, we have about 350 people who work in the kind of the operations of unemployment, and at any one time, between 125 and maybe 175 are on the phones, and the balance are working to do the decision making that allows us to pay people benefits and running the system. But we endeavor to keep those hold times to a rate that is fair to our customers and that allows us to make decisions so we can pay people timely. Of the people who apply for unemployment, 70% were laid off for lack of work. And those are very simple. We simply, if they tell us they're laid off, it was lack of work, they're available for work, they honestly get paid quite quickly. 22% of the people who apply for unemployment were fired. And we need to then determine if they were fired for misconduct, which keeps them from collecting unemployment, or for poor performance or some other reason. And there is a decision-making process. And our standard is to make those decisions within 21 days of the application. And we do that more than 80% of the time. It takes a questionnaire that goes to the worker and to the employer and it takes people to look at those. And that's what the balance of people are doing when making those decisions. About 8% of people who apply for unemployment have quit their jobs. And again, a decision needs to be made if they quit for an eligible reason. You can quit under some circumstances to care for a ill child or parent, and we can go through the reasons. Those 30% between quit and fired are what requires adjudication or decision making. And those, we are as timely as we have ever been, but it's still, there are times when it's taking time. Unemployment insurance can be simple if you're laid off for lack of work and you're available for work, and fairly complicated under some other circumstances. So that's the budget. $746 million for workforce development and community and economic development, $42 million to run unemployment, $1 billion in benefits last year, state and federal. It will be more like $1.3 billion in 2009. Let me talk about a couple of success stories, and then I'd like to take your questions. Workforce center usage for 2008 got higher as we got later in the year, and it's probably at all-time record numbers today. We recently increased the number of computers available in our workforce centers from 500 to 550. The 46 or 47 workforce centers range in size from 3 total employees in Mora or Rainy River to 100 at Bloomington South, and nearly that at Minneapolis North. We served 98,000 individual customers. We visited 617,000 times during 2008. Workshops are one of the critical things we do, and interestingly, people who tell us, I hadn't been laid off for 15 years, how you look for a job has changed dramatically in that time. 15 years ago, jobs were in the classified section of the newspaper, and you applied with a paper resume or an application or by going to an employer's office. It has moved to where 98% of job listings are online, and most employers want you to apply online. And so it has been, finding a job in the 21st century is different than it was as little as 5 years ago. And so workshops we run on job search online, job search in the 21st century, creative job search, resume, interview skills are very important. And nearly 37,000 Minnesotans attended the workshops in 2008. We upgraded the jobs database. Some of you may remember the Minnesota Jobs Network. The federal government made a change in 2007, and states were kind of on their own to create a job bank. We have a new job bank called MinnesotaWorks.net. I'd invite you to look at it. About 83,000 job seekers registered during 2008. We have about 9,000 employers that use it regularly. On any given day, there are between 9,000 and 15,000 job postings on the system, and there are between 40,000 and 50,000 job seekers. It isn't all the jobs in the state, but it's a free service to employers, and it's working. We're pleased with the way it's working. In addition to workforce services, we've had some success in the economic development area, some of which we play a minor role in because communities and companies do most of the work. Occasionally, we play a greater role. We use tools like job opportunity building zones in Greater Minnesota. The Minnesota Investment Fund, which is a revolving loan fund where we work with communities to make loans of up to $500,000 to companies that add jobs. We help with site selection, and if you haven't looked at it, MNPRO.com is a source of community profiles and listings of available job sites. We assist in community redevelopment projects like contaminated sites cleanup, and the redevelopment funds that are heavily subscribed and have a great return on investment. We assist entrepreneurs and small business through 9 small business development centers, 1 in the metro area and 8 in Greater Minnesota. They work with about 3,500 businesses last year. We have a kind of 3-part strategy in working with businesses to help existing businesses stay in Minnesota and grow, to attract businesses from other places, and to help people who have ideas or very small businesses, help our entrepreneurs. Some in high-tech businesses, some in retail, and a wide variety of areas to grow their business. One aspect of that is a program we work with partners that's only available in low-income areas of Minneapolis, St. Paul, and the first-ring suburbs called the Urban Initiative Revolving Loan Fund. And we work with people like the African Economic Development Center, the Latino Economic Development Center, MEDA, and others to fund loans from $5,000 to $100,000 to entrepreneurs in urban areas, It has been a great success over the years. We work with a variety of partners around the state to provide similar services in greater Minnesota. Our various programs, we believe, we know, between in 2008, worked with businesses to retain and create about 14,000 jobs, to leverage about $1.4 billion in private investment. That's between 2004 and 2008. I think I have been through that one. The unemployment trust fund is an issue that we should all be concerned about. You have seen items in the newspaper that in some states the unemployment trust funds have run out of money. That's not true in Minnesota. We finished calendar 2008 with about $500 million in the trust fund. However, we paid more benefits in 2008 than we collected taxes, which happens in a downturn. And under current projections, we're likely to go into deficit in early 2010. When that happens, we will automatically borrow from the federal unemployment insurance trust fund. And there are mechanisms in current law and in federal law for that to be repaid with interest over time. We have borrowed from the federal government in a number of times in the past. We have borrowed in 1975, 1980 through 86, and 2003 through 2005. The highest amount of borrowing was in that 80 to 86 period when we at one point owed the federal government about $500 million. Which have adjusted for inflation to today's dollars is about $1 billion. We paid out of that by 1988. We will keep you up to date on the projections. I think in 2011 we may owe the federal government $1 billion under current projections, and that would be paid back by employers either to some extent through our surcharge that we have in place and also through a reduction in the federal what's called the FUTA credit. And so I wanted the key message is that Minnesota workers who are owed unemployment will collect it. There's no one needs to worry. Employers will pay it, and employers will pay, if we have to borrow from the federal government, they'll pay that back that loan in interest and pay it back over time. And so we are in a little better shape than some other states. We will not always be in this kind of shape, but we don't need to worry about an inability to pay benefits. And I apologize if this slide jump around a little, but it's a complex agency with interesting programs. Recent successes in addition to business assistance and unemployment insurance include community assistance, where we've provided from 2004 to 2008 about $221 million through programs like the Small Cities Grants. Small Cities Grants need a little explanation. Those of you in metropolitan areas, in Minneapolis-St. Paul, or Duluth, or St. Cloud, or Rochester, your communities are entitlement recipients of community development block grant funds from the Department of Housing and Urban Development. Communities that are smaller than that, cities in rural Minnesota, are not entitlement recipients of CDBG funds, and so they compete for a statewide pool of about $20 million a year through the Small Cities Grant Program. And those are dollars that can be used for housing revitalization, for downtown cleanup projects, for homeownership, home revitalization projects. We typically get about 80 applications from communities around the state and fund between 30 and 40 grants through the Small Cities Program. Also included in this category are contaminated sites cleanup, the Redevelopment Fund, and some brownfields programs that have an excellent return on investment. They get money back to work. Contaminated sites are, the law indicates that we do it half in the metro area and half in greater Minnesota. We often have insufficient applications from greater Minnesota to use half, and so a little more than half the dollars tend to go to the metro area. We tend to have more contaminated sites. In the last round, that wasn't entirely true. Duluth has had a number of grants for projects like Clyde Iron Works and the airport. Mountain Iron and Plate Lakes have had projects. But in general, there's a little more of these dollars go to the metro area. If you are wondering what we're going to be proposing in 2009, the governor will have some comments on economic development in his State of the State speech and some ideas in the budget. But we've announced a green jobs, clean tech idea. in which, very honestly, we relied on ideas that legislators had come up with that we really like and that we're working with. And we, one of them is the Green Job Z that Senator Alan Anderson and others introduced. Another is our tax credits for angel investors and for community capital companies that were introduced by Senator Bach, and I believe Senator Representative Welty was a co-author on that. And the clean and green initiative is part of the fact that we currently have about 50,000 green jobs or jobs in green industries in Minnesota, and we believe there's a tremendous opportunity to increase that. And so we'll be working with you on a green and clean initiative in 2009. A couple of other programs you should know about. You may have seen in your local areas, particularly those of you, well, that we now have them all over the state. We funded, using federal dollars, a series of grants called FIRST Grants, and it's an acronym for Framework for Integrated Regional Strategies, to assist traditional workforce development, traditional economic development, traditional education, and housing interest, housing groups, to work together creating regional strategies. One round of 9 grants was done in late 2007. Another group was done in 2008, and there are now a total of 14 first projects going on around the state on the theory that prosperity isn't just about housing or just about economic development or just about workforce development. It requires a lot of systems to work together, and we're proud of that, those efforts, and we thank our partners in those. Minnesota was also one of a total now of 13 states, 3 in recent years, to win a grant round from the U.S. Department of Labor called WIRED, and it stands for Workforce Innovation and Regional Economic Development. We won a $5 million grant from the U.S. Department of Labor to do workforce development in what we called advanced agriculture, essentially biofuels, biotech, high-tech agriculture. And it covers a 37-county area of southeastern, south-central Minnesota and a triangle up to Clay County in the Moorhead area. And there is we have 3 years to invest $5 million principally in workforce development in that large area of southern and western rural Minnesota. With that, I want to check with my team to see what I forgot or mangled, and then I would love to take your questions. What did I forget or mangle? I forgot a program. In addition to the ones I mentioned, we operate under contract with the U.S. Department of Labor, a program called Disability Determination. And interestingly enough, Social Security disability is paid by the federal government, paid by the Social Security Administration. But they contract with the 50 states to determine eligibility. And we have about 140 state employees, 110 roughly full processors, and about 30 contract medical professionals. They're in the Metro Square building in downtown St. Paul who do disability determination on behalf of the federal government. 100% paid for by the Social Security Administration, but done by state employees in St. Paul. Did I forget anything else? Oh, I've been corrected. I gave Business and Community Development way too many employees. I said they had 150. They only have 61. It's an amazing amount of work they get done. Other corrections.
Is that after this session? Or
No, that's today, Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
We would be happy to stand for your question.
Representative Mahoney, did you have another follow-up at all? Questions then from the committee. Commissioner, just to touch on, maybe Mr. Nelson can come down and tell us a little bit about the UI fund and the extensions and predictions on what's going to happen to the fund, et cetera.
All right. Coming down is Lee Nelson, who is...
Representative Murphy. Okay. Incidentally, Representative Murphy, I do want to tell the committee, last year for those members, for the last session... PFI was under the jurisdiction of this committee, but now it is over at Representative Murphy's committee. Harry Coleman is the director of that. It's under deed, but it's not under our jurisdiction because Representative Murphy is the only one in the legislature besides her Senate counterpart who's going to have money to spend on. So I suggest all of you cozy up to Representative Murphy and get to know her good. And, that's why Hunt is over there already. to give her a ring or what?
Mr. Chair, it would be nice to cozy up Representative Murphy, whether she had money in her committee or not. She's a delightful human being, and you should recognize
that. I know
that.
And Representative Murphy knows that I have cozied up to her for years when she didn't have money. So, Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Chair. Commissioner, before we get off of that Social Security stuff, and so those are state employees that determine eligibility, the people's disability for receiving federal Social Security disability money.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Murphy, that's correct.
Then how come the people have such a hard time getting it?
And have to hire attorneys.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Murphy, we make those determinations, state employees make those determinations based on standards set by the U.S. Social Security Administration. And the standards are set to be a relatively high threshold, particularly for the initial determination. And we don't get to set those standards. Now, if you ask me, why don't federal employees do this, or why is it done with state employees, the only answer I can give you is it's always been done that way. It's been done that way since the beginning. But we don't get to set the standards by which people are judged to be disabled or eligible. Those are set by the U.S. Social Security Administration.
Representative Murphy?
And Mr. Chair, it's an observation that I've made. Some constituent cases that have been brought to my attention. If we try to intercede as representatives, we don't have any luck. But if the Congressman's office calls the state employees to add information, they have more luck because of the federal standards.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Murphy, I think I'm going to say let me check on that. My impression is the calls go to the U.S. Social Security Administration rather than to our disability determiners. And so the U.S. Social Security Administration, being a federal agency, I believe responds more to congressional inquiries. But let me check with the people who do that work, and we'll get back to you. Because that's an area of the department, because it does federal work, and although I try to visit them occasionally, I try to know what they're doing, I'm not as familiar with every detail. But my understanding is, let me just check with ILC, who supervises that. The calls go to the federal office, and that's our state office.
They go both places.
Let's follow up with Representative Murphy as to how we'll check and get back to you.
Thank you for the clarification.
Okay. Mr. Nelson, welcome. Welcome back from Florida.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
It was 34 below and embarrassed this morning. Colder in Fergus Falls, so we appreciate you coming back.
Mr. Chairman, would you like me to go over, for example, the federal extension, or do you have specific questions?
I think when I mentioned coming in, let's talk firstly about what's going to happen with the economy the way it is to the trust fund and how that, maybe just a primer on how it works for the committee and your predictions, and then a discussion on the federal extension and what, if you want to even touch on what Representative Mahoney is trying to do to get more people to qualify for that by having some state changes.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I am Lee Nelson. I'm an attorney for the department, and I work primarily on unemployment insurance issues. One thing I do want to correct my boss. If Minnesota's unemployment rate mirrors the national average, which is projected throughout 2009, the Minnesota Unemployment Insurance Trust Fund will go into deficit status about Christmas of 2009. We will end the year with a negative balance of $34 million. If we mirror the national average, if we come in with less unemployment than the national average, we will obviously go into the year with a positive balance. But we could be in deficit status as early as late December. And as the commissioner indicated, we'll go out in the end of the first quarter of 2011, if we mirror the national average of just close to $1 billion shortfall, we'll be in deficit to the federal treasury. We do borrow automatically. It's all been set in law. And we have to pay interest. Minnesota employers would be charged a special surcharge on the current taxes to pay that those interest. The system,
Mr. Nelson, is that formula in our statute laws, or is it a federal law formula?
It's
for that payback, that surcharge on our employers here in the state.
Mr. Chairman, that's in state law, but federal law requires a separate mechanism to pay the interest. Body a few years ago simply chose to put a surcharge on employers. The state has to come up with a separate mechanism. You can't use regular UI taxes to pay the interest. You have to come up with a separate funding mechanism, and a special surcharge was attached.
Representative Duncan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Nelson, with the federal government lending money at zero interest to various companies in the United States that are in trouble, since we'll be in trouble also, do we anticipate our interest being zero?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gunther, no. The rate had we borrowed in 2008 would have been 4.8%. The rate for 2009 has not yet been set. It is determined towards the end of this month. It will be determined and set for the year, any borrowing throughout the year. It's a mix of short and long-term federal securities. So we would expect that 4.8% rate to drop, but I don't know to what.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, you had asked earlier about the current federal extension in place. Currently, federal law in Minnesota provides up to 33 weeks of federally funded extended benefits. I should tell you that in current law, you have to be collecting that federal extension by the end of March, or you don't qualify. And we do expect Congress to extend that date out quite a ways into the future. But currently in Minnesota, it's 33 weeks of the federal extension. That is in addition to the up to 26 weeks of regular state benefits. I will also point out to this committee that it is very likely that Minnesota will trigger on what's called the State Federal Extended Benefit Program, which is found in 268.115 of the statutes, which would provide an additional 13 weeks in addition to those, for a total of 72 weeks, of up to 72 weeks of unemployment benefits. That would trigger on if Minnesota's unemployment rate for three consecutive months equals 6.5% or more. We are projecting that we will trigger on to that special state-federal extension, which is half state-funded and half federally funded, sometime in March or April.
That's the extra 13 weeks.
On top of the 33 weeks of federal, on top of the 26 of state.
In what order do you collect?
They collect in the order of course regular state benefits, then they would collect the 33 weeks of the federal extension, and then the 13 weeks of the special state federal extension.
And the Mahoney bill we will be discussing on Thursday, and probably fast tracking out of here, will enable more Minnesotans to qualify for which extension, the 33 or the 13 or both?
Mr. Chairman, currently a federal extension, about 10% of Minnesotans who exhaust regular state benefits do not qualify for those federal extended benefits because of certain earnings threshold, and it's kind of an anomaly in Minnesota law why they don't, and I won't get into it, but about at this point, but about 10% of persons who exhaust regular entitlement do not qualify for that federal extension.
For 33 weeks.
For 33 weeks, and Representative Mahoney is bringing forth an initiative to provide those additional benefits to those people who do not qualify for that federal extension, and that's what his bill does, and a few other more technical things than that, but primarily that's what it does.
Thank you. And Mr. Nelson, or Representative Mahoney, do you, what are your estimates as far as how many more Minnesotans will qualify with that law change you're going to need?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, depending on exactly when the bill would be enacted, if it's enacted this week, we would estimate that we would send out notice to 13,000 people. Now, given the estimate of given how many people qualified for the federal extension, we sent out over 40,000 letters, and about 20% of that, about 9,000 immediately requested benefits. So we would expect about 20% of those 13,000 to be currently unemployed and request that extension. So we're estimating about 3,000 people would request that special state extension right away, and an additional 150 people a week. There's currently about 1,500 people a week are exhausting regular state entitlement, and about 10% of those don't qualify for the federal extension. So we would expect a little over 3,000 people the first week.
Representative Reiner, did you have a question? Okay. Go ahead then. Anything else to add, Mr. Nelson?
Well,
can I ask Lee to explain? There's a provision in law that is interesting to those who are in high unemployment counties. Could you explain the extension? It may not be needed if we trigger the state extended benefit, but we have a current provision that can allow some extra benefits to those who are in counties who over a period of time have a very high unemployment rate. I'd like Lee to explain that, please.
Past last session, Mr. Committee, past last session was bill which provided for an extension for counties whose unemployment rates for 12 consecutive months were at least 1.8 times the state average. Initially, when that was enacted, three counties were covered, Clearwater, Kennebec, and Red Lake. But the state unemployment rate has increased faster than the unemployment rate in each of those counties, so actually Red Lake fell off. Currently, that extension applies only to Clearwater and Kennebec County. But there was also a provision in there that the amount of any state extension was reduced by any federal extension. So the federal extension has essentially eliminated that, all but for a handful of people. And again, it's those who don't qualify for the federal extension are receiving the special state extension, but only in those counties. So currently there are about 8 people collecting under those extensions. But if the federal extension were to kick off, then that state extension would immediately kick back on in Clearwater and Kennebec counties in Minnesota.
Representative Norris.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This, I guess, would be for the Commissioner. Where I live, we're probably seeing less effect of the current recession. I think we've had 75 jobs that we know of that are being eliminated in a couple of months. But we also have at least a couple of businesses looking at expanding to our community. So my question of the Commissioner, among all of the doom and gloom that we hear, are, is this happening? Are you aware of some business expansions in the state during this downturn?
Representative Nornes, thank you for the question. Yes, we are. And some of them are in particular industries that are outperforming. A couple of them are up in the Iron Range area where Minnesota Steel is moving ahead. We met with their leaders a week or two ago, and they've let a contract for the steel mill, the mine to metal steel complex. Steel Dynamics is going ahead. Unfortunately, at the same time that there's short-term layoffs in that industry, but they believe there is long-term demand. We're also continuing to see some expansions by European manufacturers that have chosen Minnesota. We recently announced a company moving to Red Wing called Hydro Controls. It's an Italian company that makes hydraulic components for the farm equipment and construction equipment industry. We have seen two Minnesota companies move jobs here recently from other parts of the state because of productivity here. A company called Norwood Publishing moved jobs from Cedar Rapids, Iowa to Red Wing. And a company called IWCL Direct, that some of us remember as Instant Web, closed a facility in Cary, North Carolina, and moved 350 jobs to the Chaska-Chanhassen area. We continue to work with companies that have announced plans that have not yet broken ground, like the Moventus, a Finnish wind turbine manufacturer that is has purchased a site in Baraboo, and we have a variety of other. There continue to be some expansions in some industries. One of the large ones is McQuay and Plymouth has spent about $75 million in additional facilities in Plymouth, Ohio, and Faribault. They make very energy efficient heating and air conditioning for the commercial markets, and they're growing rapidly around the world, and they like Minnesota. So there are, even though we've been losing jobs, there are a few good news stories represented by Norton also.
Norton, the chair.
I do, and this is stepping back just a little bit to your unemployment question. I'm wondering if it's possible to get a little bit of data about the 30% adjudication that you mentioned. It seems like there was an upswing this year in calls, at least to my office over the summer, about this particular area. And I'm interested in finding out, of that 30% that you have to make the decision on, how many are approved and how many aren't. Of those that aren't, how many appeal? And then the status of those appeals, how many ultimately are approved? I would be interested in that data if I could get it. And maybe you know.
Mr. Nelson, do you want to try to get that? Or I suppose you, knowing you, you probably have that at the top here.
I can answer that right now.
You do. Okay, go ahead. I should have suspected. Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Norton, those, surprisingly or maybe not surprisingly, the statistics stay relatively constant. The number of people, out of the number of people discharged last year, which we determined were fired, we're talking about 45,000 adjudications, one-third of those are denied initially. The initial determination is a denial. Two-thirds, we found no misconduct in the initial determination. When we talk in terms of quits, we're talking about 12,000. We make about 12,000 determinations on quit. About 90% of those are denied. It's actually a little over that. Over 90% are denied. Because they're fairly stringent. While there are nine, if you quit, you're denied benefits unless you fall under one of nine exceptions. And those nine exceptions are fairly narrow. So over 90% of everyone who quits is in fact denied benefits. One in five of all those, that percentage, so you're looking at, you know, almost 60,000 determinations on separation, one in five are appealed on a separation condition. Now, that's both by an applicant or by an employer. If someone is held not denied benefits, an employer may well file the appeal. On the reversal rate by unemployment law judges on all appeals, goes at upwards of about 40%. But you have to understand, you're getting sworn testimony. You're getting people, so you can ask in-depth questions. Otherwise, an initial adjudication is just done on a questionnaire. And now you can get a long explanation, and you can get direct testimony by the witnesses, as opposed to just a statement from an HR director or an applicant gets an opportunity to fully explain why he left the job, as opposed to trying to do it in a small questionnaire. Some people don't articulate the reasons very well, and when they get an opportunity to testify, they can prevail. So that I can give you breakdowns on the statistics, how much the time it takes for appeals and all of those kinds of things. We have a lot of federal standards because we are federally funded, and we are required to meet a lot of timeliness standards. And quite frankly, Minnesota, for the first time, as the Commissioner did mention, we are now meeting timeliness standards this past summer for that initial adjudication. It's one of the first times in about 5 years we've met the federal standards, which are very quick. We have to do, as you said, over 75% within 21 days, but that's, you get, it's actually a little shorter than that because it's 21 days from the effective date of an account, and you can backdate an account in weeks. You may have less than 2 weeks to make that determination. And you send out a questionnaire to the employer. You have to give the employer an opportunity to respond back. And it's 10 days under the law. So you have to gather all that, look at them, and issue a written determination all within 21 days from the effective date of the account. And as I said, some accounts can be backdated. It's a relatively short period of time. And so you make sometimes, say you make those determinations very quickly, and there are a lot of them. And to
Mr. Nelson, and Commissioner, you know, the last couple of years I've tried to, in the omnibus bill, had real people in East Brookport Center, and I don't know if it's the governor's office or you have fought me on that, but how does one get some help from a real person to understand what you just told the committee, which I'm sure 4/5 of us didn't understand, but how do you get help from a real live human being, because the computer is not going to help you with this specific.
Mr. Chairman, we do have people in most workforce centers, not always every day, but we're increasing the number of people in workforce centers. Our business service representatives, for example, are at least one day a week in the workforce centers. Unemployment insurance has added 8 more customer service people that are in the workforce centers. They have reemployment assistance people that are in the workforce centers. And if you call our 800 number, and it's on your handout, there are people generally between 125 and 200 people at any given time answering the phone that will do their best to help you.
And Mr. Chair, Commissioner, the $1 million that you were trying to get out of the Workforce Development Fund for putting staff in the workforce centers, what happened on Monday for committee's information?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, the issue the chairman raised is a discussion we had with the Job Skills Partnership Committee or Job Skills Partnership Board yesterday. Interestingly enough, your letter arrived in my office after the Job Skills Partnership Board met, so I didn't have the benefit of your advice until we'd already made the decision, but we made a decision that agrees with you, and that is that we will move...
And here back to the U.S. Postal Service.
Yeah. The board decided to move funds to the workforce service areas, but not to use those funds to hire additional state employees at this time. For a number of reasons, the board was concerned about setting a precedent of hiring state employees out of that fund, and also we're concerned about how we could continue the funding when we're uncertain as to the state of federal Wagner-Pfizer Act or other dollars in the future. So we provided approximately $5.6 million from the Workforce Investment Board to the formula funding or small layoff funding to the workforce service areas. We had reduced the estimate of what would be helpful to have state employees to about $400,000, Mr. Chair. We did not make that transfer for the reasons I indicated. So we essentially took your advice.
So are you taking Wagner-Pfizer money or somewhere else and getting to put those folks one day a week or 2 days a week or shift them around, or where are you finding the money for that?
There are those positions, Mr. Chairman, members of current job service employees whose assignment has been to assist employers in finding employees, called business service specialists. They're funded from federal Wagner-Pfizer Act. The Wagner-Pfizer Act is a very balanced law. It tells us to spend 50% of our money helping workers and 50% helping employers. We sometimes the help of employers has been indirect, but we used currently funded Wagner-Pfizer positions, Mr. Chair, to move those people at least one day a week, and in some cases it may be more than that, into the workforce centers to help workers. One of the reasons to use state employees is under federal law, they can access unemployment insurance account details. Federal law prohibits non-state employees from having access to unemployment insurance. So employees of the workforce service areas can't access or get the detail to assist Representative Norton's customer, a state employee, whether they're in the workforce center or in our customer service center, under federal law is only authorized to access that detail. That's one of the reasons that Job Skills Partnership Board adding state employees. We didn't have a pay to pay for them in the long term. So the decision was made not to hire more state employees out of the Workforce Development Fund and to reallocate some existing employees to meet that need.
Well, Commissioner, I just hope with this economic situation that we have that we do have some high bodies, because Representative Norton isn't the only legislator to be getting calls, and I know I've gotten a ton of them too, and you have improved the phone lines and the electronic filing and that, but there are a lot of the people that are getting laid off now have not been laid off in recent years, and a lot of them are like me, a technological nightmare. I got an iPhone, members, and I've already trashed it twice in 3 days that where it actually shut off. So, you know, I mean, Andy, I need your help. Teach me how to use it.
I don't even know how to use it.
He's older than Paul.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Representative McFarland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner McElroy, I don't like to assume anything. Can you tell me how the state calculates its unemployment rate?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. The unemployment rate is calculated based on a survey taken by, you know, rather than do that, I'm going to bring up an expert. Dr. Hahn, please could you... Steve Hine is the Director of Research for Labor Market Information, and he can explain in some detail. There is a popular misconception that the published unemployment rate has to do with unemployment insurance, and it does not. It is done by a very sophisticated survey tool that Dr. Hine can explain.
Dr. Hine, welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much, Representative Rukavina and members of the committee. I appreciate the question. I love talking about this. The monthly unemployment rate for the state is derived from this monthly survey that the Bureau of Labor Statistics conducts each month of households, asking people whether they're working or not, and if they're not working, whether they're actively looking for work and available to work. The national unemployment rate, that was just released at 7.2% for December last Friday. That's derived entirely from the set of responses to those questions from about 60,000 households nationally. Within the state, we currently have about 800 households that are asked that question, a lot fewer households than are asked about what TV shows they watched last week. So that's not a large enough number to get an estimate that's reliable enough for us to have a great deal of faith in. So we take that number and then we do econometric modeling, all right? So it would be correlated with the number of jobs that we've added and the number of people that are collecting unemployment benefits. So there is a connection only in the form of that econometric modeling exercise. And so we basically look at this survey result, model it with these job numbers and UI claims numbers, and extract from that then what we think is a reliable estimate.
Mr. Hine, is our modeling similar to what other states do?
Every state does it the same way. Their models may differ depending on the historic correlations between unemployment and things like claims and jobs, but the same methodology is applied in each state.
And does it take into account, for instance, that a lot of maybe some poor, really poor down and out folks that are unemployed might not even have a phone to answer a survey? Or
the current population survey is actually conducted by the Census Bureau on behalf of the Bureau of Labor Statistics. So I think it gives these people something to do between 10 years.
So they actually make an actual contact.
So they make an actual contact that in the first month. They go to the house and they knock on the door, and there's if there's nobody there or the house is foreclosed on, they have ways of filling that specific spot with somebody that is meant to represent the same subset of the population. And then each month subsequent to that, there's telephone follow-up. And the overall response rate's well into the 90%. So.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How do you calculate the counties then? Because you talked about some of the benefits by county.
Right. Because, that does not use this survey as the basis. That's based on modeling this statewide unemployment rate and then looking at county and city level claims information from the UI system to distribute that employment across the counties and cities that we estimate. Right.
Okay. That's in well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the Commissioner, I just want to say that I did send a correspondence off to the Governor and also to the Chairs of the Committee in regards to an individual from my district who contacted me because it was right before Christmas. He had been waiting a while to get a response back as to why his unemployment wasn't being paid, and this was facing foreclosure if he didn't get his check. And the governor sent off the correspondence to you, and you sent me a real nice correspondence saying essentially, and I had asked, you know, could we direct some resources because of the numbers that I'm sure that we're going to have and the increase. And you had responded that you were in the process of redirecting staff. And I, by reading this, I just want to thank you for acknowledging, you know, what people are going through, because it's easy to read numbers in the paper, but we as representatives, we get to hear the personal stories. And we get the letters and we get the correspondence and we have to respond to our constituents. And I just want to thank you for responding to that. And I also want you to send back a word of thanks to the employees who are coming in on Sundays and who are working, and to those who are taking, you know, the extra time to come in and respond to our constituents back in our district. You don't always hear that in the paper. And many times we hear the, you know, the people talking about seeing state employees in this manner or that manner. And I just want to get the message across that I acknowledge that we have our state employees coming in on Sundays and on weekends to do the work. I acknowledge that we have our state employees coming in and putting in overtime, taking away time from family in order to meet the needs of the state. And I want to personally thank them and thank you.
Mr. Chairman, convey that message to your employees.
It will be my honor to convey it, and thank you. We have had a number of state employees work voluntary overtime. It's not required, but many people, both they want the work, but they also want to help your constituents, our mutual constituents. And I make a point, if somebody calls and asks for the commissioner, I talk to him or I call him back. Because you're right, each of these people, they're not a number, they're a unique story. I talked to a gentleman this morning whose employer hadn't given him a W-2 or paid the UI tax or done the paperwork right, and it kept this gentleman from collecting his unemployment. Unfortunately, we were able to track down the employer, get it straightened out, get him paid yesterday. But it has a huge impact on his family and on individuals, and it's often not the worker's fault. It is simply the circumstances. And I think Lee brought up an interesting fact. People are discharged. It's not at all uncommon for them to be eligible for unemployment, because the law is very specific. You're only ineligible if you're guilty of misconduct. If they simply, you don't get along, or you have a personality conflict, or maybe even poor performance, you can still collect unemployment. So when you're discharged, a lot of people are eligible. And by all means, they should, if we can't tell that from the questionnaires, they should speak up. And a fair number of those are corrected.
From what I heard for the answer to Representative Norton, my observation is you hate your job, get in a fight with somebody so you get fired so you can collect unemployment rather than quit.
But Representative Norton, you need to be a little careful, because if you get in a physical fight and you slug them, that's fifth degree assault.
It just seems it was a lot easier to get fired and collect. Yep. And it was to quit.
That's correct. That's
all. Commissioner, I did want to ask you, you know, in light of, and we're running out of time, but, you know, in light of just what's going on here, do you have one or two, are you thinking about like an emergency job program like we had under Purpose Administration, the MEAD program that I think Representative Clark was the chief author on here 20-some years ago when the economic crisis wasn't, I don't think anywhere near what we're looking at today. Is there some? I mean, you're the Department of Employment and Economic Development, and you're going to play an important role in both taking care of the people losing their jobs and trying to find some way to stimulate the economy. So, you got any good ideas for us?
We have some, although one of our best ideas.
Mr. Hines, if you want to. If there are any more questions for Mr. Hines?
Yeah, you can step back and get out of the way.
Or Mr. Hines, do you have any ideas for jobs?
Mr. Chairman, one of the ideas that we are putting forth and are working on actually will fall under Chairman Murphy's jurisdiction. The Public Facilities Authority has made more money available to local communities to do clean water projects and sewage treatment projects. Because for a number of reasons, they are really good economic development. They put people to work. They help communities be ready for economic development. But I will be honest, one of the reasons we're doing it is because there isn't a lot of construction activity. Bids are coming in about 30% below engineer's estimates. And so communities are getting really good deals right now. And so the board of the PFA decided in July to make more low-interest loans and financing available. And we have worked with a number of communities, including Wilmer and Litchfield, a wide variety of others. Communities as large as Wilmer, and that's an $88 million project, and as small as Keister, Minnesota, which I think is in Representative Gunther's district.
It's in Cornish, right.
Which is a town of 500 and had had sewage treatment collection in the past. And so that's one issue. Second issue is we're continuing to work very hard to attract manufacturers, European and Asian manufacturers, to build facilities in Minnesota. And I can't make any announcements today because we always guarantee companies that they get to announce their own products or their own projects. But because the dollar is so weak against the euro, Minnesota looks like a great place to manufacture to Europeans. And we have, I think, five or six fairly significant European manufacturers looking at expansions in Minnesota, and we're excited about that. We're also beginning to see the effects of the transportation bill create more jobs in roads and bridges, particularly bridges, and the bonding bill of project get into the ground. And so we see those as a good thing. We also... In the past, we have kept a balance in the Workforce Development Fund of $5 million, which was both for cash flow but for a rainy day fund. And we have, and it's raining. And so we have... we've sent it to the Workforce Development Areas, to the 16 WSAs, to make available to assist people in small labs. So that at yesterday's JobSkills partnership meeting, we moved back $2.4 million, Mr. Chairman, that you may have recalled had been moved from the Workforce Development Fund to JobSkills Partnership for Low-Income Grants. That was moved back to the Workforce Development Fund and made available to the 16 workforce service areas to assist people who've been laid off in small layoffs, layoffs of less than 50 people. The vast majority of people who lose their job in Minnesota are in small layoffs, and so we've made more dollars available there. Mr. Chairman, as I mentioned, the governor has five initiatives along green technology and clean technology that we believe are opportunities, and we're continuing to participate with the Biobusiness Alliance and the wind power industry. We see those as growth industries, and to work with communities when they have economic development opportunities.
Okay. I see we're out of time, so thank you, Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You've got a big job ahead of you in a couple of different areas, and I'd like to work with you because I have some ideas. But,
all right.
Members,
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Mahoney.
I just wanted to remind the members of tomorrow's, unless you were going to the Humphrey
Institute. I said it when you were out of the room that your bill was coming in.
No, not my bill, but the Humphrey Institute seminar tomorrow on, will have a lot to do with economic development and the future of what our state's going to be looking at.
And on Thursday, we have Commissioner Swiggum. And next week, members, we've got the Office of Higher Education, and I decided next week when they're here to actually have a little discussion on financial aids and bring in both the Office of Higher Education, the university system, the Minsky system, and the private colleges to talk about the whole financial aid picture. And then Thursday at the University of Minnesota, and I've asked the President Brunick to also bring in the chancellors from the different campuses too, so we can hear from them, which they probably don't want to talk out of school in front of their president, but you know, they do have different issues. So members, thank you, Commissioner, thank you so much. Meeting's adjourned.
Yeah.